Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 4th of January, 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. It's the first Real Britannia of the new year, so happy 2021 to all our listeners, and of course, happy new year to my co-host of the show today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, hello, sir. Happy new year. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, and a happy new year to you too. I had a surprisingly good Christmas and New Year period, bearing in mind the various lockdown measures and things that were in place. I think with a bit of ingenuity, it's always possible to work around these kind of restrictions and still have a good time. So that was quite pleasing for me.
I think the main thing that really sort of stuck out from New Year to me was Sadiq Khan's firework display. An absolutely abominable display of left-wing politics. He had loving the NHS there, he had the rainbow there, he had the raised Black Lives Matter fist there, they had some poetry over the top of it that was all about anti-racism and everybody coming together, and there's been so many complaints about that today, and then we look over at Wuhan and we see that everybody's out in Wuhan in China. They're all celebrating. They're all acting as if, you know, there's no such thing as coronavirus. And of course, we weren't allowed out at all on New Year's Eve. And I was just looking at these two things and I was thinking about it. And I was thinking, well, what's really happened in China is that they've worked out that the actual number of deaths from this year is no different to the actual number of deaths from last year. So if they don't actually bother to test for coronavirus, then people end up dying of heart attacks, they end up dying of emphysema, pneumonia, and it's all older people that would be dying anyway. So it doesn't really matter. And I was thinking, well, why aren't we doing this? And of course, the reason why we aren't doing this is because we have an individualist society. What we have here is we have a virus that takes out 99.97% of people survive. And if you have an ethnically homogenous society, if you have an ethnostate like they have in China, that means, well, so what? 0.03% of the population are going to die. 0.03% of the Chinese are going to die. It doesn't matter. If you're looking at an individualist society, if you're looking at a multicultural society, that is 100% of one individual that is dying. So it suddenly becomes far more important for them to prevent this from happening, because they're looking at everybody as individuals instead of looking at them all as being one group that is essentially the same. And if you're Chinese and it's 100% Chinese, what does it matter if 0.03% of the population or 0.5% say of the population that are over 80 end up dying? You still got masses of Chinese people there. The actual group, the Chinese group, hasn't been harmed in any way whatsoever. But we look at it as everybody is an individual, and it's 100% of one individual that is dying from coronavirus. Therefore, we must shut everything down and lock down and destroy the economy. And I think it's these two different ways of looking at things. It just struck me today, Max. What do you think of that theory?
Well, I've written and spoken on a number of occasions on this subject before, actually, and I've pointed out that there are over 200 different viruses, rhinoviruses, influenza viruses, adenoviruses, and coronaviruses that cause the flu and the common cold in various combinations. And these have existed for decades in many cases, and for hundreds of years in some cases, and ever since humans first inhabited this planet in some cases as well. And the point is that we've grown to live with them. It's been 100 years since the Spanish flu that affected us in 1919. And in all that time, there hasn't been a vaccine that's been produced to protect us from the common cold, because there are so many of these viruses. There hasn't been a vaccine that's been produced that can protect us from all of the influenza viruses. And so even though people take their flu shots once a year, lots of people do. I've never done so. But although lots of people take their flu shots each year, lots of them still end up getting flu because they end up getting a different strain of flu from the strain that was used to make the vaccine that particular year. And so what's happened is that historically we have recognized that, as you pointed out, that in excess of 99% of people will actually survive getting one of these kind of illnesses. And so therefore, they haven't been regarded in the past as being as dangerous or as threatening as they're viewed today. And it's quite unusual that this one coronavirus, because there are many coronaviruses, but just this one coronavirus, which is one of, as I say, over 200 different viruses that cause these kind of cold and flu-like symptoms, which can, in people who are elderly or in people who have compromised immunity, can lead on to lower respiratory tract infections, which is basically pneumonia, which can then lead on to people dying. And so people, you know, have always died. But we've never before had a media which has indulged in Project Fear in the way that the media have done over the last year. And I think that the media have been largely responsible for panicking government into taking very, very extreme measures and very damaging measures as far as our economy is concerned. And so it is very regrettable that that situation exists. And you're quite right in pointing out that the increasing individuality, which is being promoted by the media and has been so for several decades now, that increasing individuality is making us as a race of people, the white race, and making us as the British people, as the nations of Europe, making us more and more reactionary when a threat of a virus of this sort comes about. And I think that what should have been done originally was that we should have done what I've advocated all along, which is that we should have divided the population into two groups. One group, which would be the shielded group, which would be people who have reduced immunity either through a great age or through some other form of infirmity, and that they should have, that the government should have made arrangements to protect those people and shield those people from the virus. And the rest of the population should have been people basically who are the younger section of the population, those that are still actively working today. And those people should have been allowed to carry on working in the normal way. And had we done that, then the massive increase in public expenditure that we've undertaken already over the last 12 months would not have been required. And so the country would be much less indebted than it is now. Production and our economic output would have been maintained, and so we would be in a much stronger financial position. And so that's the obvious thing that should have been done. And the point is that we're reaching a stage now where government and people in the media are saying, oh, you know, the end is in sight now because we've got a vaccine, and yet that vaccine may be effective against the original strains of coronavirus, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it will continue to be effective against all the strains of coronavirus, because even if we take COVID-19, which I think was called severe acute respiratory syndrome, so SAR, SARS-CoV-2, so SARS-CoV-2, which is known as COVID-19 now. So COVID-19 has mutated already, and it's in the news that there's this new strain. Well, there isn't one new strain. There are actually several new strains that have come into existence over the course of the last 12 months. Several that we know of already, and there probably are lots more, because the original strain of COVID-19 was replaced fairly quickly by a strain which is called D614G. And D614G is now, or was up until recently, the dominant strain throughout the world. So that the D164 or 614G spread faster and therefore overtook the original strain. So the original strain was then marginalized, and D614G became the dominant strain. Then there was another strain that developed in Spain because of all the people going on holiday there, which was called A222V. From A222V and D614G, there have been other mutations. And so there's another mutation, which is called N601Y. And then the latest mutation that everybody's talking about has been given a somewhat different designation. It's called H69/V70. And this is the one that we're now being told is extra dangerous because it's the one that spreads faster than the virus has done beforehand. As if this is something, and Boris Johnson was interviewed on the Mar show earlier on today, and on Sunday, and he said that nobody could have foreseen that this new faster spreading strain could have come along. Well, the point is that the D614G strain was a new faster spreading strain, and that came out much earlier on last year, and nobody took that into account. And now we've got this other faster spreading strain. But the point is that if you have a series of partial lockdowns, then what those partial lockdowns is that they prevent a certain range of virus organisms from being able to multiply and spread. So if you have any virus, it doesn't have to be coronavirus, but if you have a virus within the population of those virus organisms, there'll be some organisms that are more infectious than others. There'll be some that will be or have a greater effect than others. There'll be some that and there will be different characteristics, just as there are, you know, in any given population of people. There'll be some people who are tall and some people that are short, some people that can jump very high, some people that can't jump very high. And the point is that if you take a virus where there is a range of infectiousness naturally within that virus population, and you then have a partial lockdown where the group which is less infectious is prevented from multiplying and spreading, but the group which is more infectious is the only one which is able to multiply and spread and therefore become the dominant strain, you are effectively creating the selective breeding conditions necessary to ensure that the outcome will be a faster spreading, more infectious version of that virus. So if you apply a partial lockdown, and a lockdown where not everybody stays indoors. So if you have a lockdown where everybody stays indoors and nobody goes out for perhaaps an entire month, then that might kill the entire virus. But the point is, if you have lots of short lockdowns that last for just a couple of weeks so that some of the virus survives, and the bit that survives is the most infectious part of the virus, then what you're doing is you're creating the conditions whereby a new, more infectious version of the virus is going to evolve and therefore going to infect people in the future. So that demonstrates the stupidity. And that's just basic Darwinian principles of survival of the fittest. And it just demonstrates the stupidity of current government policy.
So they've just created the situation, haven't they? I mean, they've just created the situation the way that it is. But also, as you were pointing out there, these vaccines that are created, they're created to deal with one strain. And by the time they come out with the vaccines, there's a new strain which is sufficiently different from the first one to make the vaccines invalid. There's no point in even having them. So what are they going to do? Another lockdown? Another vaccine? What they have to do is they just have to look at it as this is something that we're going to have to live with. And if we had an ethnically homogenous society like they have in Taiwan, like they have in Vietnam, like they have in China, like they have in all the countries that don't have a problem with coronavirus, we would be looking at it. Well, it's just a tiny percentage of our people that are susceptible to this. We don't need to be doing the lockdowns. But our mentality is, we're all individuals. We're all separate individuals. We have multiculturalism, and we have to stop this because it kills a whole individual. It's a totally different way of looking at it, isn't it? And that's why all those countries in the Far East don't have a problem with it, because they have ethnostates.
Yeah, and if you look at countries, I mean, one of the things that's always struck me about the coronavirus and the way it's been reported is the inconsistencies that exist, because we have all been told that how terrible the impact of the disease would be unless we took these extreme measures. And yet there are countries who haven't taken these extreme measures where they haven't noticed any difference. And so, for example, if you look at Belarus, in Belarus, the president there, Lukashenko, he basically declared that the COVID-19 was a kind of a hoax virus. He's not saying that there is no virus called COVID-19, but what he's saying is that COVID-19 is so little different from the flu and so little different from the common cold that it isn't worth regarding it as something new and far more threatening. And he kind of has jokingly suggested that if his people feel as suffering the symptoms of COVID-19, they should just drink more vodka. But the point is that there aren't massively more people dying of COVID-19 in Belarus, and there are no reports of COVID-19 in existence in Belarus. And again, if you look at Africa, a continent of countries, most of which are far too poor to be able to afford mass vaccinations anyway, the governments there just don't talk about it. And so you never hear of COVID-19 in Africa because everybody's just ignored it.
They also have much younger populations, don't they? I mean, 60% of some African countries are under the age of 30, so that they're not in the group that is likely to actually become susceptible to this. I mean, there is all these different ways of looking at it. Did you see, just incidentally, did you see Belarus on New Year's Eve? They had all these balls for the youth there, and they're all dressed up to the nines and ball dancing, and then you compare that to what was happening in New York, where there was somebody in a car that was just mobbed by all these blacks. They smashing bicycles through the windscreen of the car, trying to get at the people that were inside, because the people that were inside didn't want to tow hoodlums on their push bikes along behind the car. I mean, it was quite a contrast to see this is what's happening in New York and this is what's happening in Minsk. I mean, people will complain about Lukashenko. They'll say, well, he's a leftover from the communist regime and he still has a lot of communist ideas. Belarus is still 99.9% white. So it doesn't matter what happens to Belarus. They will always be able to pull through. They will always have their Belarusian nation. Our capital city is now 60% non-white, and I would rather have a white communist country than end up being blended out by non-whites and have no more nation left, no more people left, no more of my extended family left. I mean, Belarus is in a far better situation, and Lukashenko, I mean, it doesn't seem that bad for me when you compare him to Boris Johnson, who has really lost all the support that he originally had. I mean, his last chance, I think, was with this Brexit deal. And he had told us that he was going to stand hard and fast, and if we didn't get a good deal, we were going to leave with no deal. Well, he's done his deal now, and he did what I predicted he would do. He has stabbed the fishermen in the back. We are still tied in to the common fisheries policy. All these countries in Europe still have all these quotas. We still have a tiny part of the quota. Their boats can still fish up to 12 miles from the shore. Some of them can actually come within the 12-mile limit. And we're stuck like that for 5 years. And that's Boris's deal. The fishermen are not happy about this. I know you've been looking at Boris in a little bit more detail as well, Max. What are your thoughts on Boris and his Brexit deal?
Well, as far as Boris is concerned, this time last year, Boris was kind of like a hero because he had negotiated the leaving agreement from the European Union, and he had reassured everybody that an economic trade agreement was oven ready and was virtually a done deal. And what's happened is that in the 12 months that have just elapsed, it's become apparent that the trade agreement with the European Union wasn't a done deal by any stretch of the imagination. It was a much greater wrangle than people had expected, to the point where we've had all these problems with businesses being frantic, not knowing quite, you know, how they need to handle their exports, what paperwork they need in order to export to the continent, and wondering whether they're still going to have a business in this new year, and so they've been put under a tremendous amount of stress, which will have lost the Conservatives and Boris in particular a great amount of respect. When we left the European Union, a lot of people voted for Brexit because what they wanted was less non-white immigration into this country. They wanted less immigration, but more specifically, they wanted less non-white immigration into this country. And what the Conservatives have done is that they have reduced the amount of immigration to Britain from the continent of Europe, which was overwhelmingly white immigrants, and they've set up this points-based system where they are sort of gleefully expecting that we will have immigrants from all over the world, which means primarily from third world countries, will be coming to Britain instead. And so I think a lot of people have become upset with Boris over that as well, because the Conservatives have obviously not done what everybody knows the majority of people who were opposed to immigration actually want. But one thing that always winds me up about Boris is the fact that when he appears on television and when he's photographed and he appears in the media, his hair looks like he's just been dragged through a hedge backwards. And the point is that this has been sort of explained as being a kind of a signature of his, that he's got this unruly hair. But the one of the things that struck me in business before I retired was that there were people who were who felt themselves to be extremely successful in their line of business, almost to the point where they were like almost icons of that particular business. And whereas most people in business would want to attract new customers by dressing smartly and presenting themselves smartly, this minority of people who felt that they were so fabulously famous and wealthy that they could effectively do what they want, they would turn up to business meetings in a T-shirt, whereas everybody else would be wearing a suit and a collar and tie. And this basically is a demonstration on that part, on the part of people that do that kind of thing, that they feel that they're so important that they don't have to dress up for anybody else, and that they just expect everybody else to dress up for them. So they can just, you know, fall out of bed, pull on a pair of jeans with holes in the knees, put on a scruffy T-shirt and go off to the office. And that's so important, that's so iconic, that nobody will ever criticize them. Nobody will ever point out that they're being rude to the people that they're doing business with. Because by making a statement like that, that I'm so important that I don't need to dress for you, but you need to dress for me, obviously, that is incredibly rude. And my belief is that Boris Johnson's hair is his way of demonstrating to everybody else just how incredibly important he is. He's so important, so iconic, so wealthy, that he doesn't have to comb his hair as a sign of respect to the people that he's going to meet and do business with during the course of the day. He just expects everybody else to accept the fact that he's got this big mop of unruly hair on the top of his head and carry on regardless. And by and large, people do, which is, more is the shame. And when I was watching the Andrew Marr show yesterday morning, I was wondering why, in all of the conversation they have, Andrew Marr just doesn't have the courage to say to him, "And Boris, why is it that you don't have a hairbrush? Why can't you brush your hair in the morning? When you come to the studio and everybody else has their makeup put on and everybody else has their hair combed and everything, so they come out and they're on television looking nice and smart, you tell," presumably that's what he must do, "you refuse to let the makeup artists and things comb your hair because you want to appear to be all shaggy and untidy. Why is that? Why do you have so little respect for the public that you want to vote for you?" And that's the sort of question that I would like to pose to Boris Johnson as well.
I think I've seen him do it on purpose. He messes his hair up on purpose. I've seen him have it all neat, and then he sees that he's just about to be on a camera, and he scruffs it all up on the top of his head to try and make himself look like a schoolboy. That apparently that's why he does it. He's been doing that since he was at school. But it is insulting to everybody else that dresses up for it. I mean, just to get onto that immigration thing there, it's like Boris hears people saying, "We don't want any more immigration. We don't want any more immigration." And he says, "What? You want more immigration? You want more black immigration? Do you want 3 million people from Hong Kong? That's what you voted for Brexit for, wasn't it? You wanted 3 million people to come over from Hong Kong, the Antifa types from Hong Kong that China doesn't want because they cause trouble." I mean, that's his latest thing, isn't it? They're going to give passports to 3 million Hong Kongese so that they can move into Scotland and turn Scotland into Scong Kong and a Scott Kong and a high powered business district. That's their plan. They just totally ignore what the people say. That Brexit vote was overwhelmingly by people that wanted an end to immigration. And their plan has not been to end immigration. They've said, oh, you want to end immigration? Yes, we hear that as you want a points-based system, which means we can let in people from all over the world. It's disgraceful what he's done. The Labour Party are no better. What happens is the Labour Party get in, they put in policies, and then the Conservative Party come in and they conserve the Labour Party's policies. And everything just goes further and further to the left. It just gets more and more progressive. People vote the Conservatives in because they think they are going to conserve things. But when you actually look at their record, they've done nothing like that. I mean, just look at David Cameron. Did he say in his manifesto that he was going to bring gay marriage in? He was going to totally rewrite what the word marriage actually meant and change it from the meaning that it has had for thousands of years, the consummation of a marriage between a man and a woman with the view to producing a child. They're going to change that to the sin of sodomy. I mean, did he put that in his manifesto? No, he didn't. And he's totally changed everything by doing that, from everything that the children are taught. You know, you see children's books now that feature two homosexual men with a child that they have apparently adopted. I mean, when you actually see two homosexual men with a child, I mean, it is so jarring to the system, because you know that something wrong is with that picture. I mean, it may be that those two homosexual men they wouldn't harm a hair on that child's head. But the instinct that you have when you see two adult men with a child is rescue that child. What is going on there? It goes completely against all your instincts. And it was the Conservative Party that brought that in. But what can we do? The alternative was Jeremy Corbyn. And now the alternative is Keir Starmer. Do you think people might finally actually vote for a nationalist alternative next time around, Max?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think that there are only so many times you can fool people. Although I can't quite remember who it was. It was P.T. Barnum, I think, who said that you can and nobody ever lost money by underestimating the intelligence of the American public. And I think that a lot of our politicians over here have being of a similar mind. They just think that the voting public in this country is so stupid that they can do whatever they like and they'll continue to get elected in again. I think that the Brexit Party showed that it isn't necessarily the case, because there was the European election that was overwhelmingly won by the Brexit Party, and so that's shown that the public are prepared eventually to realise that if they want change, then they've got to vote for the party that's offering them that change. And as far as the Brexit referendum was concerned, the public again decided that they would vote to get us out of the European Union. So, you know, there have been two occasions recently where the public have actually voted for what we want. I just hope that people recognise now that that's what they've got to do. They can't keep on falling time and time again for the con artists of the establishment parties, and that they have to vote and that they have to start voting quickly now, because time is running out. They've got to start voting quickly for political parties that want to save this nation and keep Britain British.
We do have that actor. I've forgotten his name for the minute. The anti-political correctness actor that is
Fox.
Fox, that's it. Yes, and he's getting a party together, which it seems to me to be similar to the Brexit Party. It's basically racist liberalism is what they want. They're against ethno-nationalism. They just want racist liberalism and no political correctness, which is really a dead end. What we really need is a proper nationalist party. I mean, perhaps Patriotic Alternative will be in a position to field candidates by the time we have another election. When is it? Is it 5 years' time, 4 years' time, Max? You know more about these elections than me.
I think it's going to be another 4 years some, although I think that there was a move recently, and I don't know whether it actually was passed into law, but there was a move recently to abolish the are the fixed parliamentary periods because of all the trouble that caused Boris in terms of getting the majority that he needed in order to pass the legislation so that we could leave the European Union. So I think that it may be that that there won't necessarily be a fixed 5-year period until the next general election. I think it may be that, well, certainly before that 5-year period is up, the law may be changed so that the Prime Minister can call a general election whenever they want to. So Boris Johnson is likely to call a general election when it's most convenient to him. And one of the sad things about recent developments is that because of the COVID pandemic and the panic that's been caused in the media as a result of that, the government have been able to invoke all sorts of emergency procedures that were only supposed to ever be used in the case of a national emergency, so that they can rule effectively by edict. And it's in recent times, really, that we've seen demonstrators in central London being very brutally suppressed by the police. When we were talking about Lukashenko and we were talking about Belarus earlier on, it sort of occurred to me there that when the police in Belarus dealt quite forthrightly with people who demonstrated against the legitimacy of the last elections in Belarus, in which Lukashenko was re-elected, this was portrayed in our TV and our media as very brutal and deplorable, and that the international community should condemn it, etc. And yet when the government in this country authorized the police to use very similar brutal methods to suppress demonstrations in our country, and when they're able to make sweeping edicts banning public meetings, banning gatherings of people gatherings of more than six people, etc., all this kind of thing, the mass media in this country just meekly roll over and let it happen, and that you don't hear a word out of them. And so, you know, what we can see in this country is that the government in this country is becoming more authoritarian, and it's employing more and more authoritarian measures. With the Terrorism Act and I can't think of the name of any of the other acts off the top of my head. There are a lot of these emergency measures that were designed initially only to be used in instances of war, for example, where there was an actual disaster, are now being introduced to cover everyday occurrences. And I think one of the most glaring examples of these kind of measures is the issuing of £10,000 fines. £10,000 is an amount of money that most people couldn't scrape together if they needed to, and it would be a very severe assault upon the average working person's economic circumstances if they were suddenly required to fine £10,000. And I think the government know this, and this is being used in order to prevent there being any mass demonstrations, the fear of being given a £10,000 fine. Well, the governments can only go on doing that sort of thing for so long before they sufficiently lose popularity so that they will be replaced. It may, it may be within a decade. It may take, as it did with the Soviet Union, it may take, what did the Soviet Union last for, something like 90 years. It may take 90 years before the people in this country manage to summon up the courage to get rid of the corrupt governments that we have at the moment. But hopefully it will happen one day.
It will eventually happen. I believe with those fines that the people that have been given those fines have then challenged them in court, and they've won. Piers Corbyn in particular has been handed a number of these £10,000 fines, and every one of them he's managed to beat by challenging it and taking it to court, because I believe they go against the constitution. I mean, they're even saying, I think, no more than two people can protest now, and that has to be against the constitution. But of course, if you're black, if it's a Black Lives Matter protest, that's absolutely fine. The police will just get down on their knees for you then, in subservience to you. But if you're white and you're protesting, then expect to get a few heads cracked. Well, let's get into our greatest Britain. Should we get into greatest Britain's, Max? Finished with the other stuff?
That'd be good.
Okay, let's get into Isambard Kingdom Brunel. We began talking about Isambard Kingdom Brunel in the last episode, so let's begin with a recap here. Isambard Kingdom Brunel was English, but of French extraction, and he came from a family of engineers. He was educated to a very high standard from a very young age, learning the classics at 8, going to university at 14, and he began work as assistant engineer to his father, the chief engineer, on a tunnel under the Thames, where they developed a special shield for digging under the water. The tunnel was intended for horse and carriage, but was then used by pedestrians and became more of a tourist attraction and a curiosity than anything else, until 30 years later when it was purchased by the East London Railway, and it is still in use today as part of the London Underground. It was thanks to the popularisation of rail by Isambard Kingdom Brunel that that actually happened. And just before the tunnel was actually finished, Brunel began work on the Great Western Railway, running from London to Bristol and Exeter. And Brunel had a vision of continuing the railway over the sea to New York by steamship, leaving from Nealand, Wales. And he did all the surveying himself for this railway, and he wanted to widen the gauge of the rail to over 7 foot so the trains could go faster and carry more weight. But it was decided to stay with the standard gauge that had been formalised by George Stephenson instead, which was 4 foot, 8.5 inches. And we discussed last week about how that was the same gauge that was used for the horse and chariots that we had when Julius Caesar arrived on the island. And that's where we got up to. Is there anything else you want to add to that? Any thoughts that come to mind as I'm going through that, Max?
No, that all seems to be very... very much in line with what I recall that we covered last time. But I think one of the things that we said was the building of the Great Western Railway and the plans to have a shipping link to take people from Nayland in Wales across to New York. That just demonstrates the forward thinking nature of Brunel. Part of what we've established about his character, that he was somebody who was very forward thinking and not just somebody who was preoccupied with the matters of the day.
Well, we've always been visionaries, haven't we? We're always reaching for something more. That's something that the white race does. It's not unique to the British people, but we're always reaching for more, always trying to go one step further. I mean, that was part of this reason why they dug underneath the Thames. It just hadn't been done before, so somebody needed to do it. So they dug all the way underneath the Thames, and then it was after they had actually done that they thought of a use for this tunnel, which really gives us this is the thing with being white. We have to conquer things. We have to go all the way around the world. If there's something that we can see that hasn't been done before, we have to try and do it just because it's there. Why do we climb mountains? Because the mountains are there. I'm not sure if non-whites even climbed mountains before we thought of the idea of doing that. Anyway, getting back to Isambard Kingdom Brunel here. Drawing on his experience with the Thames Tunnel, the Great Western Railway contained a series of impressive achievements. Soaring viaducts like the one in Ivybridge, specially designed stations and vast tunnels, including the Box Tunnel, which was the longest railway tunnel in the world at that time. There is a rumour that the Box Tunnel may have been deliberately aligned to ensure the rising sun shone all the way through it on Brunel's birthday. And they must have taken that idea from Stonehenge, which obviously has the sun on the solstice. So they lined this tunnel up so that the sun would shine through it on Brunel's birthday. The initial group of locomotives ordered by Brunel to his own specifications proved unsatisfactory, apart from the North Star locomotive. So a 20-year-old Daniel Gooch, later Sir Daniel, was appointed as superintendent for locomotive engines. Brunel and Gooch chose to locate their locomotive works at the village of Swindon, at the point where the gradual ascent from London turned into the steeper descent to the Avon Valley at Bath. So it was really because of this, I guess, that Swindon got turned into a city. It's quite a large size now, isn't it, Swindon? And all of that must have been due to this building these railways. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
Well, just I can remember, I don't know whether this sort of thing is taught in schools nowadays. So few young people I meet seem to have knowledge of this kind of thing, but historical geography, up until the middle of the last century, Swindon was a location where there were large factories producing locomotives, and I think that it's possible that more locomotives were being produced at Swindon than at any other location throughout the UK.
And alongside that, obviously, they had to build houses and all sorts of other things. And we'll hear later on what that generated. It seems to me Isambard Kingdom Brunel was quite like he was our Henry Ford, like the British Henry Ford. But we'll see more of why that is later on. Though unsuccessful, one of Brunel's more interesting uses of technical innovations was the atmospheric railway, where instead of using steam locomotion, the trains were moved by Clegg and Samuder's patented system of atmospheric vacuum traction, whereby stationary pumps sucked air from a pipe placed in the centre of the track. And I did a little bit of research on Clegg and Samuder, and they were actually shipbuilders as well as engineers. So I think it was his connections with them that may have helped when he got into the shipbuilding later on. So you can see, when we talked like in the last episode about how he studied under a watchmaker, and we talked about how all these different disciplines needed to be understood so that you could solve these problems, we can see here that somebody that was actually a shipbuilder was also using what they had learned at shipbuilding to come up with this idea of atmospheric traction.
The section, interestingly, that's very similar to a project that I think Elon Musk was involved in, where he was trying to create a modern kind of pollution-free railway system. There were experiments done, and I think it was using vacuum to, or it might have been using electromagnets, but it was a similar kind of principle anyway, where the trains would be travelling through a tunnel. And so, you know, here we are like 100 years later, and still there are innovators that are using, that are trying to build on the work that was done by Brunel 100 years ago.
Oh, yeah, a lot of these techniques are still in use. With this, even with that game, isn't it? We're like, almost like ice hockey, the game with the air that comes up through the table. It's like a pool table, and it's got a little puck on it, and you move it about. It's that sort of principle there, but used for a railway. The section from Exeter to Newton, now Newton Abbot, was completed on this principle, with trains running at approximately 68 miles an hour. Pumping stations with distinctive square chimneys were sited at 2-mile intervals with 15-inch pipes used on the level portions and 22-inch ones for the steeper gradients. The technology for this required the use of leather flaps to seal the vacuum pipes, but the natural oils were drawn out of the leather by the vacuum, which made it vulnerable to water, causing it to rot within. Because of this, the fibres broke when it froze during the winter of 1847. It was then decided to keep it supple with tallow, but this is attractive to rats, and the flaps ended up being eaten by them, causing the vacuum operation to last for less than a year between 1847 and 1848. Deterioration of the valve due to the reaction of the tannin with iron oxide has been cited as the final straw that sank the back of the project, as the continuous valve began to tear from its rivets over most of its length, and the estimated replacement cost of £25,000 was considered too prohibitive. A number of South Devon Railway engine houses still stand, including those at Totnes, scheduled as a Grade 2 listed monument in 2007, and at Starcross. And a section of the pipe, but without the leather covers, is preserved at the Didcot Railway Centre. In 2017, inventor Max Schleyinger unveiled a working model of an updated version of the atmospheric railroad at his vineyard in the Northern California town of Ukiah. So they're still working on this in America. But what I find really interesting about this is all the problems that they encountered with this that they couldn't foresee, such as the freezing, the oils being drawn out, and then the fibres breaking when it froze, and then the rats eating it once they decided to keep it subtle with tallow. You know, you can make provisions for just about everything, and then the natural world will, you know, throw a spanner in the works.
Amazing.
These rats that ate it. And who would have thought that rats would have been the reason why this idea had to be shelved. And as you pointed out, Max, you know, that they're still doing similar things like this in America. So, and that was an example of him thinking outside of the box. This is something that had never been done before. And
it's just sad, really. They didn't have rubber in those days, and couldn't have used rubber with mineral oils to lubricate the joints between the bellows and the other engine parts.
Would they have been using steam then to make the vacuum then? Do you think that technology it would have been, wouldn't it?
I would think they would have been using steam pumps to actually create the vacuum, yes. And perhaps to operate the bellows, because otherwise they'd have had to have had lots of people at various points operating the bellows. It would have been a very labour-intensive form of transport.
Well, Brunel had proposed extending the Great Western Railway by boat from Bristol across the Atlantic Ocean to New York City before the railway opened in 1835. And despite it being widely disputed that it could actually be commercially viable for a ship powered purely by steam to make such long journeys, the Great Western Steamship Company was born. Technological developments in the early 1830s, including the invention of the surface condenser, which allowed boilers to run on salt water without stopping to be cleaned, had made longer journeys more possible, but it was generally thought that a ship would not be able to carry enough fuel for the trip and also have room for a commercial cargo. So again, we see other limitations here. Up until this point, they'd needed to have clean water. They'd needed to clean the water, which meant extra work. And also, you need to think about how much fuel is actually going to be used when you're traveling from Britain to America. So again, these limitations here, natural limitations that he's got to think of ways to overcome, which is basically what engineering is, isn't it? It's overcoming these natural limitations. Brunel applied the experimental evidence of Beaufoy, who was a nautical scientist, and further developed his theory that the amount a ship could carry increased as the cube of its dimensions, whereas the amount of resistance a ship experienced from the water as it travelled only increased by the square of its dimensions. This would mean that moving a larger ship would take proportionally less fuel than a smaller ship. To test his theory, Brunel offered his services for free to the Great Western Steamship Company, which appointed him to its building committee and entrusted him with designing its first ship, the Great Western. So we can see he's really keen to test out these ideas so much that he's going to offer his services for free, because he wants to be the first to actually do this. Do you want to make any comments on these bits here, Max?
Each one of these things further demonstrates Brunel's determination to advanced technology and industry in making life easier and better for the people at the time. You know, the digging of the tunnel under the Thames, the creation of railways, the vision of having a mode of transport all the way from London to New York. All of these things demonstrate his desire to make science, or to put science at the aid of man, so that we could make life better and improve our situation.
And also, if you look at the things that he was creating, like the bridges and the viaducts, they're really aesthetically pleasing. I mean, they're really beautiful constructions when you compare them to the architecture of today. He wasn't just trying to build things that had great utility, but also things that were extremely pleasing to the eye. And a lot of the steampunk genre that we have today, that owes a lot of its aesthetics to Isambard Kingdom Brunel and the things that he built. When it was built, the Great Western was the longest ship in the world, at 236 foot with a 250 foot keel. She was constructed mainly from wood, but Brunel added bolts and iron diagonal reinforcements to maintain the keel's strength. And in addition to her steam powered paddle wheels, the ship also carried four masts for sails. She finally embarked on her maiden voyage from Avonmouth, Bristol, to New York on 8th of April, 1838, with 600 long tons of coal, cargo and 7 passengers on board. Brunel himself missed this initial crossing, having been injured during a fire aboard the vessel as she was returning from being fitted out in London. As the fire delayed the launch by several days, the Great Western missed its opportunity to claim the title of being the first ship to cross the Atlantic under steam power alone. But even with a 4-day head start, the competing Sirius only arrived 1 day earlier, and its crew was forced to burn cabin furniture, spare yards, and 1 mast for fuel in order to do so.
That's amazing.
Not really such a great achievement, is it, when you hear that, you know, having to set fire to everything, whereas the Great Western got there with just using the coal that it brought and its cargo and its 7 passengers with them. In contrast, the Great Western crossing of the Atlantic took 15 days and 5 hours, with the ship arriving at her destination with a third of its coal still remaining, demonstrating that Brunel's calculations were indeed correct. The Great Western had proved the viability of commercial transatlantic steamship service, and the Great Western Steamboat Company would go on to use her in regular service between Bristol and New York from 1838 to 1846. She made 64 crossings in all, and was the first vessel to hold the Blue Riband, which is an unofficial accolade given to the ship with the fastest average speed rather than passage time, with a crossing time of 13 days westbound and 12 days 6 hours eastbound. The service was commercially successful enough for a sister ship to soon be needed, and Brunel was asked once again to design her. So he's made a couple of records here. He's made the largest ship in the world. He's also got the fastest average crossing time, and he was also almost the first vessel to make it to New York. He was the first vessel to make it to New York with coal left over, with excess coal left over on board, I guess we could say. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
I can't remember the exact time and who was responsible, but it was around this time that the first telegraph cables were being laid across the Atlantic as well, between London and New York. And so again, that's a similar feat. I'm not sure who was responsible for that, but it
showed. Have a guess.
Was it Brunel?
Yeah, it was one of his ships. One of his ships was it. I mean, the guy was just, you know, so responsible for so much that happened in the Victorian era. He really is one of our greatest Britons. We wouldn't have a lot of the things that we have today if it wasn't for him, and particularly in the Industrial Revolution. Well, by this time, Brunel had become convinced of the superiority of the propeller to the paddle wheel. After tests conducted aboard the prop-driven steamship Archimedes, he incorporated a large 6-bladed propeller into his design for the 322-foot Great Britain, which was then launched in 1843. The Great Britain is considered to be the first modern ship, being built of metal rather than timber, powered by an engine rather than wind or oars, and driven by a propeller rather than a paddle wheel. She was the first iron-hulled, propeller-driven ship to cross the Atlantic Ocean, as well as the longest ship in the world, and her maiden voyage was made in September 1845 from Liverpool to New York. In 1846, she ran aground at Dundrum, County Down, but was salvaged and then employed in the Australian service, taking gold prospectors out to the colony. She is currently fully preserved and open for the public to view and explore in the British city of Bristol. And apparently she's been completely renovated and all tidied up, and people can go and see her. And she was just rotting away. I mean, you think this was one of the... Well, this was the largest ship in the world at the time, the first ship to be made entirely of metal, with the first propeller-driven ship to cross the Atlantic Ocean, and it was just being left to rot. So it's great that it's being looked after today, and people can go and have a look at it. So he just continues to keep breaking all these records, basically. Yeah. In 1852, Brunel turned to a third ship, which would be larger than all her predecessors and intended for voyages to India and Australia. The Great Eastern, originally dubbed the Leviathan, was cutting-edge technology for her time. Almost 700 foot long, fitted out with the most luxurious of apartments, and capable of carrying over 4,000 passengers. The Great Eastern was designed to cruise non-stop from London to Sydney and back again, since the engineers of the time mistakenly believed Australia had no coal reserves, and she remained the largest ship ever built until the start of the 20th century. So actually, in actual fact, he could have made compensations for that. You know, he need not have actually brought so much coal with him. He needed to only make the space to bring half as much coal. I mean, that's quite a way to go, isn't it? All the way to Australia and back. And you think of the time it would take. I mean, it's taking, 12 days to get to New York, and all on coal and steam. Like many of Brunel's ambitious projects, the ship soon ran over budget and behind schedule in the face of a series of technical problems, and has been portrayed as a white elephant by some. But it has been argued by David P. Billington that in this case, Brunel's failure was principally one of economics. His ships were simply years ahead of their time. His vision and engineering innovations made the building of large-scale, prop-driven, all-metal steamships a practical reality, but the prevailing economic and industrial conditions meant that it would be several decades before transoceanic steamship travel emerged as a viable industry. The Great Eastern was built at John Scott Russell's Napier Yard in London, and after two trial trips in 1859, set forth on her maiden voyage from Southampton to New York on the 17th of June 1860. Although a failure in her original purpose of passenger travel, she eventually found a role as an oceanic telegraph cable layer, and under Captain Sir James Anderson, the Great Eastern played a significant role in laying the first lasting transatlantic telegraph cable, which finally enabled reliable telecommunications between Europe and North America. So that's his connection there. It was the Great Eastern. It was the third ship that he built that actually ended up being responsible for laying this telegraph cable so that we could talk to America. Do you want to add any comments to that, Max?
Well, I think that in terms of being able to talk from both, from London to America, that would have been a linking the two largest economies of the world at that time. And so that it's an obvious thing for somebody to do. And all of these innovations and designs that Brunel created all contributed to making transport and communication around the world quicker and therefore more timely and efficient than it otherwise would have been. And I was thinking as you were talking then about a story that we covered some while back where it involved Gary Lineker being in a short film where he was claiming that fish and chips weren't invented by the British because we didn't know how to fry fish until 1860. And here we are talking about Brunel designing, the first iron ships that were able to sail from one side of the world to the other and back again, non-stop. And yet, apparently, according to the people that sort of did the research for Gary Lineker, we didn't know how to fry fish at that point in time, which just makes that claim utterly ridiculous, doesn't it?
It does. I find it interesting here that they say that he was so far ahead of his time. So, he was building these steamships and coming up with these ideas to get around the problems, but they just couldn't really afford to do what he wanted to do. It would cost so much money. And also the skill that was required, they didn't yet have these skills yet. So, but in a couple of decades' time, they did have the money and they did have the skills. And we had these steamships that would regularly travel across from Britain to America. And I guess that would have tied in with masses of colonists and pioneers traveling out there when it really became popular to go over to America. I should imagine before this time, the people that were going over to America were people that had been kidnapped off the streets, basically, and sent over there as indentured servants because they were seen as villains, which just meant villagers over here. They were seen as vagrants. And they used to just literally take them off the streets and put them on the ships and send them off to America because they thought, well, they're not doing anything in Britain. And if we send them to America, they got a chance to make something of their lives. if they looked on it in a positive way. And of course, these people, once they were freed, they were quite happy to be over there in America and could buy a bit of land after the indentured servitude was up. So it's an amazing time to be alive, I think, around this time. Very, very harsh life, but great leaps forward in technology and innovation. And all this came about through steam, basically, with George Stephenson starting with his locomotives, and then we get to here, and we get to them starting to make ships from it, and as we talked about earlier, using it for vacuum possibilities. It's like just finding all these different applications that they could for steam, and making the largest ships in the world out of it. And it must have also seemed incredible to have a ship that was made entirely of iron, which sinks. Yeah. You know, that's an achievement in itself, and it's also an example of thinking laterally, isn't it? Again, thinking outside the box. I think Brunel really did think outside the box with so many of these ideas. I don't know if there was anybody else that was thinking of doing anything like this. I haven't heard of anybody else doing this. It was these ideas that must have just popped into his mind. Well, I think we should leave it there, Max, and get into a third part of this next week, unless you've got anything else you'd like to add.
No, that sounds like a good idea.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.